So, welcome everybody. I'm Alan Fletcher. I'm president of the Aspen Music Festival and School. Welcome to this first of seven High Notes presentations that we'll be having this summer in our 2020 virtual season. So, some of you may be wondering, what is High Notes? If you've never been to one, this is a once a week, very informal conversation that I have with artists who will be appearing later in that same week. Talking about what they're up to, what they're doing, their repertoire, et cetera. It's just a chance to get to know the wonderful artists who come to Aspen, or in this case, who are appearing through Aspen. And it will be possible in each segment for you to make comments or questions. And the way you do that, if you're not familiar with Zoom, is go down to the bottom of your screen. There's a little thing that says chat. Click on that. And you will find a way to enter your question. And what I would suggest is that if you have any comment or question, enter it immediately when you think of it. Don't wait for me to say any questions. Just go ahead and put it in there. We will collect them and then hope to get to them. So we're going to start. We're going to do the program today, hour long, in two half an hour segments. And the first presents artists who are going to be with us in our next Sunday. Presentation, so Sunday, July 12th, and that is violinist James Ennis and pianist Andrew Armstrong. Now, James and Andrew are well known to us in Aspen, and they gave a Beethoven violin sonatas recital in 2018, which was to be part of a cycle of the complete Beethoven sonatas for violin and piano, and the remaining two concerts would have been this summer. They're doing excerpts from those concerts now, but they will be back with us live in Aspen 2021 to complete that Beethoven cycle. So I want to welcome Andrew and James.
And there's Hello, Alan. James.
Hello.
Hello. Hello, Alan. Hello.
So wonderful to see you. I understand, James, that you're at your home in Seattle, and Andrew, you're at your home in Worcester, Massachusetts.
Well, this isn't actually my home, but it's my home now.
As you know, we had our season opening event yesterday here in Harris Hall, where I am. And the artists who were here said the same thing. They said it was very emotional for them to be on a stage working with other people. And Robert Spano commented that he had gone down to Macon, Georgia to be with Bobby McDuffie and Elizabeth Pridgen when they were presenting their segment from Georgia. And he said it was the first live music I had heard in months. Yeah. And he just had tears streaming down his face from it. So now, normally I do give a little quick introduction of the artists, and we just got right into fun conversation. So I think I'll go back and just say quickly, James Ennis has played, it appears to me, with every orchestra in the world and every conductor in the world. So I'm not going to give the list. I counted two Grammys. Are there more Grammys hiding out there?
Or? No, that's all. Sorry.
Okay. The two Grammy Awards, recipient of the Order of Canada, which was very cool. You mentioned that you're artistic director at Seattle Chamber Music Society, and also founder of the Ennis Quartet. And as I said, James has been with us for a number of extremely happy and well-regarded programs here in Aspen, which is great for us. Andrew Armstrong, a pianist, also has been everywhere in the world on every continent as both soloist, concerto soloist, and in chamber music. He is James's partner in a complete Beethoven cycle, which was in progress around the world, really, quite notably in Wigmore Hall and a little to Beethoven. It strikes me as a particularly sunny program, what you're going to do on Sunday. You have the sonata in D major, opus 12, number one, which is the first sonata. And then you have the Adagio movement from opus 30, number one, and then the opus 24 F major sonata, which is nicknamed Spring Sonata, not because Beethoven called it that, but because everyone thought it's very sunny and spring-like in character. So tell me about that sunny nature. Is it just because we need that mood right now and you decided to focus on that, or is there a further plan?
I think there's something to be taken from music that is warm and friendly and comforting. And of course, there's also, you know, had we gone in the other direction, we could equally justify playing very stormy and dramatic and music as well. But I think that, you know, the first Beethoven sonata, it's such a statement. You know, Beethoven, of course, with all of his, particularly, I think, his first sets of pieces, you know, one thinks of the Opus 1 piano trios, the Opus 2 piano sonatas, the Opus 5 cello sonatas. I mean, he was very conscious, I think, of his own abilities. And I think that he wanted, with these initial statements in a genre, to say, I'm the best at this. Look what I can do. I'm not just going to kind of ease my way into a violin sonata. I'm going to write probably the largest and most technically intricate violin and piano sonata yet to be written. And it's so interesting. We've talked about this, that how the violin and the piano start in unison. Bum, ba-da-dum, ba-da-dum, ba-da-dum. And it's as if to say that this is a new form of duo between the instruments. I mean, he used the old style of saying a sonata for piano and violin, but these instruments are true duos. There's no question of who is a dominant voice or who is a subservient voice. So I think part of our thought process is with online concerts, you never really know who your audience is. And I hope that there will be a lot of people listening to this concert next week that won't know this music. This will be new for them. It'll be an adventure for them. And I think to start with the first Beethoven sonata is kind of appropriate. Plus, it's just a piece we really like.
So he was at this time really making his career, establishing his career as a pianist and composer both. And things had to be sort of showy and impressive. But the whole branch of Beethoven scholarship is called reception studies because it's not about the music as much as it's about what people heard in the music in 1802, as opposed to in 1850 or 1902 or 1950 or 2020. And so, as I think you were saying, these were very big, very dramatic sounding pieces in 1802. But now, to me, they sound very classical in style.
Well, it's interesting. The cycle of these sonatas is, I think it's fascinating as a set, but it's not like the cycle of piano sonatas, or much less like the cycle of string quartets, where you really have a much more complete overview. I mean, with the violin sonatas, I mean, the first eight of them, you don't get past Opus 30, you know, and then you have the Kreutzer, of course, the drama of that kind of iconic middle Beethoven. And then you have the 10th sonata, which is really, for me, I mean, it's one of the most important sort of transition pieces stylistically for Beethoven, where you just start to see him heading in that direction that he explores later. I think with these early sonatas, I feel that I you know, don't want to put words in your mouth, Andy, but I think that we try to create worlds within them that are not, they're somehow not influenced by what we know is coming later. Like we've joked before that, you know, we'll play like some early Beethoven sonata and think, you know, if Beethoven had died after he wrote like one violin sonata, people would be like, yeah, that's the best violin sonata ever. You know, but I think that sometimes, because, you know, Beethoven, he ends up doing different things later. And I think that sometimes it's a part of kind of human psychology that they look at what he became later. And of course, there's no question that what he did later was so monumentally great and important that maybe it sometimes overshadows in people's minds, from an intellectual standpoint, the greatness of the early music, that I think when it's performed well, it has everything. You know, I I don't think that there are better pieces than these two sonatas we're going to be playing next week. And I think that it's, but I think it's also nice, you know, when we think of Beethoven, we think of the scowl and we think of, you know, the rage of some of his music and the, you know, the journey from rage to triumph and all these romantic ideas that we have of Beethoven that yeah, it's important to think of the Beethoven that was full of charm and full of humor, that reveled in his own virtuosity, not just as a composer, but as a performer.
I'll just tell you both a story that for my series in Columbia that you referenced. I was talking with a cellist about what she would play, and she already had Defy, Suite Populaire Espagnole in there, and I said, what about Bruch Kol Nidre? And I didn't get a response, and I wrote, you know, a few days later, what did you think about Bruch Kol Nidre? And she said, I just got to be honest, with all this quarantining and all the doldrums around, when I read that, I love that piece with all my heart, but my heart just filled with dread picturing coming out and playing Kol Nidre right now. I'm desperate for sunny, happy music in a way you can't imagine.
Well, that makes sense. And, you know, I was wondering, there's the tradition of playing the Andante Favori, what was originally the slow movement for Opus 53, and then took it out. So people play that as a one-off kind of thing. I wondered if you were going for something like that.
Yeah, well, it was struck when you were talking about the idioms, the personalities of the violin and the piano, that while they are two of the sort of most mainline elements of our contemporary repertoire, they still do have their own specific personalities. And I wonder if in your experience of performing these sonatas, if you think that maybe the classical style or the heroic style or late style sits better with the duo ensemble, or they all have their, are they able to sort of bring out different characters of each of those stylistic periods of Beethoven's work?
I guess I would say that, I don't think that instrumentally that sort of one period of his life maybe necessarily fits more or less comfortably than the other. I mean, I think that there are just unique and specific challenges really to all of his works. And it's interesting how even like within the same opus, you'll find fundamentally different instrumental challenges. Like I think of the Opus 12 sonatas, and Andy, I'm sure you'll agree that it's like the challenges of the A major second sonata versus the E flat third sonata, they're just totally different pieces. I mean, the A major is all sort of delicacy and subtlety, and the E flat is like a piano concerto.
Yeah, I was just going to say the E flat, it's probably harder than the third piano concerto, I would say, to me. You know, it's tricky, and as you say, the A major sonata, the Opus 12 number 2, is it's like doing a Marcel Morceau move on a tightrope. You know, it's not the most you know, in your face athleticism, but wow, it's like playing a different instrument. It's interesting that way. But I would say also, how miraculous that Beethoven has the instruments complement each other as well as he does through those three periods that we broadly design, talk about them. And yet in each one, he absolutely captures a new voice, a new place that is, it feels like the instruments were designed and built to achieve that moment in his
and the loss of any one of them would seem like just an unimaginable tragedy.
Right. No, we feel that way very strongly as well. Well, James Hennis, Andrew Armstrong, wonderful to talk with you, and it'll be wonderful to hear your Beethoven Sonatas for Violin and Piano program, which will be on our series Sunday, July 12th at 3 p.m. Mountain Time. And you go to, well, if you're listening to me talk, you've figured out how to access us. So, but much success with your series in Seattle, and thank you.
Well, and thank you for keeping the music going through this. We're very grateful to be able to do something for you, and we look forward to seeing you in person next summer, if not before.
Great, likewise. Okay, so stay with us, though, not you guys, but participants. Stay with us because we turn now to another wonderful artist who is also presenting during this week in our virtual festival. And this is Stuart Stevenson. Stuart is the principal trumpet player of the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra. He is also a member of our faculty in Aspen, our regular faculty. And thus would have been with us teaching and performing this summer. Stuart was a student in Aspen. What years was that, Stuart?
It was 2009 and 2010. And it took me a little bit to figure that out because I was having to keep going back years and it just kept seeming further and further away. But yeah, 2009, 2010.
But that being true, you moved into a major career very quickly because you have played with Los Angeles Philharmonic, New York Philharmonic, among other great orchestras. But you won your principal position in Atlanta in 2013.
2013, yeah. So, I actually missed graduation from Northwestern on my master's to do the trial weeks for Atlanta, and I figured that was a fair trade-off. And yeah, well, I didn't have to do the freelance market, and, you know, living gig to gig, which was very lucky. And I think I'm very lucky and very happy that happened because I would have had to learn so many different, you know, things and figure out how, you know, just to work and also figure out where to live. Because I'm a Virginia native, but I was going to school in New York and then Chicago, and, you know, where would I go from there?
Yeah. Well, I would like to give Aspen a commercial by saying one of the things we are proudest of and most concerned about is to help young people into their careers as professional musicians. And the fact that within 10 years of being a student here, you joined the faculty here is pretty impressive. So what I'd like to do for the listeners is describe a little about the structure of our overall summer programming and then your role this week in it. Because in addition to recital programs like the one given by James Ennis and Andrew Armstrong, which will be on Sundays, and High Notes, which I will be leading, which will be on Mondays, on most Wednesdays and some Thursdays, we will be presenting the work of faculty and students, which is really the core of what we do as an organization. Everything else that we do in terms of presenting starts from the fact that we are a school. And so we thought, well, let's take advantage of this strange moment that we're in and really try to open a door into what happens in the studio, in the rehearsal, in the sectional, and let our devoted audience get a glimpse of our work that they wouldn't get otherwise. Because a masterclass, you know, I love masterclasses and we love presenting them live here in Aspen, but it really is a show because the participants have really prepared and they do want to show off, and then the teacher wants to show off that he or she can say that one perfect thing and get a result, and it's fun. But it's very, very different from what happens in the day-to-day work of studying music or teaching music. And it's that regular work that we want to give a picture of. So, long way of leading into the fact that Stuart is presenting two different hour-long segments, one on Wednesday and one on Thursday this week. So I believe they are at 5 p.m. Mountain Time.
5 p.m., yeah.
Great. So you can adjust for wherever you are. And he has chosen two students of trumpet who would have been with us this summer. And in the first session, they're going to be doing the kind of work that would typically here come after the first rehearsal and before the second rehearsal, if I'm getting that correct.
More or less, yeah. Before some coaching on it and before you work on it a little bit. Correct.
Yeah. So they've prepared for a symphony that's going to be played, and they're going to be the trumpet section with Stuart. And then Stuart is going to take them privately and coach them in what needs to be accomplished to get that performance ready. And it's extremely revealing and really fun. Like so many things we do in Aspen, it's fun to me because the first time you hear these students, they sound fabulous. And you know, you might just say, okay, good. Well, we're good on this, and let's go have a pizza. But then the pro is listening and says, yeah, it sounds really great. Also, it needs to sound this way. And also, you need this and this and this and this and this. And it's all very supportive and encouraging, but it's also very rigorous and demanding. And then they play again. And if you're the listener like me, you go, wow, that is better.
Yeah, it's really tricky because when you practice these all these parts independently, you might think they sound great, and they did. And you know, when I first heard their recordings, when they were playing along with me, that sounded great. But it's one of those things that it's more difficult because you're not in person. You can't feel and hear the music going on around you. But it's little things that they maybe didn't think about or weren't paying attention to just because you're not there to experience it in the same way. And it's something I think we all learn. And one of the great things about Aspen is that we do have faculty sitting in amongst the students, and they can coach us. And that's what I learned a lot of from when I was a student there, you know, how to sit in an orchestra, how to try to blend in, how to try to match the person on your left and on your right, and the person away across the stage who, for some reason, you have a part with them.
Well, on Thursday, your segment, also at 5 p.m. Mountain Time, you and those two students are now joined by Robert Spano. And he and they and you get into a really absorbing conversation about many subjects, what you do early in your career, what the particular challenges are to make your way through the audition process, to stay sane and stay healthy, and you know, what level of anxiety is right. What other things go into that?
Well, yeah, like you said, it kind of went all over the place because I had a few questions, you know, for Robert himself, because I don't usually get to talk to him one-on-one in a kind of relaxed environment. It's either usually on stage or, you know, about music or in his suite about the music, trying to figure that all out. And the students had some questions as well, and we tried to, you know, lead them in a way that was useful to everyone listening and to the students, as you know, participating. And some of it's learning, you know, what issues there are now in COVID times. And one of the big ones was learning how to use technology. And I think I'm pretty, you know, up to date on what's going on. But the more I'm in this, the more I realize that I don't know what's going on, and I'm having to play catch up a little bit. And I think younger students are, well, just because of their age and the era, they're already more on top of that than I was. And so just trying to figure out what unique new things you're going to have to worry about, and trying to figure out how to, yeah, like you said, trying to mentally and physically in shape and trying to stay sane and how to do that now.
Yeah. Well, not to give away all the secrets that are revealed on Thursday, but I was really struck by a thing you said, advice to these young people, saying, when you get to the audition location, check out where you're going to be, where you're going to be waiting, you know, where the bathroom is, et cetera. But if you find out at the last minute that you have to walk up two flights of stairs right before your audition, you're going to have your heart rate elevated, and you might blow the opening of the audition that way.
I speak that from experience, because in Atlanta, there's a flight of stairs there. I didn't personally take it up too fast. I think I was just, you know, comfortably walking. But I did see someone do that as I was coming off stage from my audition, and they looked completely out of breath. And I thought, I'm glad I didn't do that. I'm glad this is going to stick with me, you know, in my mind now. Mm-hmm. And but I think I mentioned in the videos, all these kids who come to the students come to the rehearsals very well practiced. They know their part. They're excited to learn, and they'll soak up anything you toss at them, even if it takes. Sometimes it takes a little bit longer to get it through their heads because of how you say it or how you demonstrate it. Just trying to find the right keyword to make it click.
is the nature of the rehearsal different? Robert Spano said, well, if I'm in front of Atlanta Symphony, they've all played the repertoire. They know a ton of information about general practices. And so it can be just a matter of saying, we're going to do it this way, this way, this way, this way, this way. And, you know, at the same time, what is super different? What is going to be super different about this performance? But if you've never played the piece before, that's not a sensible question. But then he said, so you get into the student orchestra thing, and there's a whole lot more information that has to be given out about style, for one thing. And then the point being, would he stop the rehearsal and say, okay, trumpets, you're playing this, you know, Mahler excerpt, and you're each phrasing it differently. And he said, oh, no. I just look at Stuart, and he looks at me, and a little current passes, like Stuart says, yeah, I'll fix that.
Yeah, we get that look occasionally, and it's the look you don't want, which is, what's going on back there, and do I need to come back there and take care of it? And yeah, you usually just want, okay, yeah, I got it. We'll get it next time. And most of the time, that's all it needs. And occasionally, we'll have to, like I said, I'll have to go up and talk to Robert and figure out, okay, why are we not on the same page? Because if I think I'm doing it a certain way, maybe he just has different expectations or hears it differently, and that's fine. And we're very willing and flexible to change that.
Yeah. Well, there was a moment a few years ago in the Conducting Academy, somehow you've reminded me of, where the timpanist played a note, a beat early in a very large, complex orchestration. You know, everybody's playing, and the timpanist just hit this note a beat early. And the young student conductor went ahead. And so finally, the teacher stops and says, okay, did you notice anything wrong there? Now, to the credit of the student, because of course the student is a brilliant musician, the student says, yeah, the timpanist was a beat late. And so the teacher says, yes, were you going to do anything? And he said, yeah, I was going to get to the end of the section and then say, hey, you know what? You were a beat late there. And so the teacher says, no, you're not going to tell a player in the Philadelphia Orchestra that they're playing late. You're going to, the second that mistake happened, you're going to look at that person. And if they give you the look back of, yeah, I know, I'll fix it, then you're done. And it's only if they appear oblivious, you know, but he said a professional is not oblivious.
Yeah, not to, you know, playing in the wrong note, wrong beat or anything like that. There's always, you know, stylistic things that we may just might not hear.
Yeah.
But yeah, usually that's all you need, just that look. It was me trying to figure out how to play everything correctly, or correctly enough anyway, figuring out what my weaknesses are, what I need to, what I'm going to have to do to make this sound right. And also just getting my own head basically and figuring out what my voice is for me as a player and for my section. Luckily I had my associate trumpet, Mike Deschone, he was very supportive and helpful those first couple of years. You know, I would ask him a question like, what are we supposed to do during this? How does this normally work? And he will just be like, here's how it normally happens. If you have a different idea, great. And so it took me a while to get my own voice, but now that I have that, I think it's easier to lead and easier to figure out what I want. But it was not an easy transition. It was pretty sudden. And I was the youngest member of the orchestra at the time. So it's kind of an awkward position to be in, especially when you're young.
So we'll wrap up for today, but thank you, Stuart Stevenson of the Atlanta Symphony and of the Aspen Music Festival and School faculty for being with us. And what's coming up in this week is Stuart's first segment with two trumpet students is Wednesday. So Wednesday at 5 p.m. Mountain Time for about an hour. And then the second segment, Stuart, those students, and Robert Spano, is Thursday, 5 p.m. Mountain Time. And then on Sunday at 3 p.m. Mountain Time, James Ennis, violin, Andrew Armstrong, piano, and a program of Beethoven sonatas. So thank you for being with us today, and we'll hope to see you online soon.